step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, and welcome back to We're Not So Different, a podcast about how we've always been idiots. My name is Luke. I am an amateurish historian, and as always, I am joined by Dr. Eleanor Yaniga, who is anything but. In this episode, our 20th on our historical materialism series, we will cover the years from about 1933 to 1945. Including the rise of fascism in Europe, Hitler, Imperial Japan, World War II, and, of course, the atom bomb. But before we get to those heavy topics, let's talk about something fun. A question from our patron Christina, who asks, did people in the Middle Ages keep pets? If so, what kind of animals? How was their treatment of pets similar or different to our own?
Good question, Christina. And the answer is yeah. They got pets. So pretty similar to us in that, like, cats and dogs are the big ones. And then also you do see birds. There are some captive birds, but then also,
oh, really?
Yeah, people would have birds, which is cute.
Like normal people. I mean, yeah. like peasants, not.
Totally. Peasant. And it's like, I mean, the birds that they would keep, are less, you know, quote unquote exotic, although you do see some imported parrots, but rich people have,
well,
you know,
parrots. It makes more sense now. I was thinking of like more exotic birds, but yeah, just like keeping normal birds makes sense. I was like, oh man, they had a, you know, some English peasant had a parakeet, and then I was like, no, you're an idiot.
No, it's like, yeah, it's stuff like, so they would keep like, you know, the cute little birds. So, you know, stuff like goldfinches or like finches are big, things like that. Doves. So that was also a big thing, is having like dove cotes and like dove houses, and like encouraging kind of doves to roost would be a big one. Of course, there's also like livestock, so like horses and stuff, but you know, field animals, it's always like a high cabbage. Speaking of pets, my cat has come to whack me. Oh, it's cabbage. Oh, hello. She was like, I heard you talking about cats. There is also, you know, for the nobility and stuff like that, then they have also things like falcons that they will keep and use for hunting. And that's quite common. So I guess major differences are like the fashions. So like a lot of the dogs that we see, or, you know, have visual records of, is kind of like, you know, people will have hunting dogs or dogs that are like really used for a purpose. But then they also have pet dogs. And pet dogs are like frequently like greyhounds and stuff are really big. People really like the kind of like greyhounds, the sort of sight hounds, stuff like that. Although towards the end of the period, you start getting like little spaniels and stuff sort of show up in paintings and stuff. Cats are kind of ubiquitous. People have a lot of cats. And, you know, cats being a very useful thing in order for pest control and stuff like that. Interestingly, medieval people are more similar to us in the whole pet thing than, for example, like early modern people, because like early modern people go through that like brief and ill-advised like thing about like kind of trying to prove that animals aren't really human by like doing vivisection and stuff like that. Like the whole scientific nature of things like really is fucked up, so like they are kind of monstrous about it. You know, also in like some of the warm weather places, you'll see stuff like monkeys, little monkeys, things like that. But in general, I suppose, one of the differences, if we're talking about stuff like horses, is sometimes if you're a peasant, your horse lives in the house with you. You know, because they often like kind of have houses that sort of like they share. Mm-hmm. With the farm animals, which is just smart in terms of like keeping things warm. Like, mm-hmm. bring the large animals inside, you know.
But not great in terms of disease.
Yeah. Not great. Absolutely. So, yeah. You know, like, you're a lot more cheek by jowl with animals, mm-hmm. in the medieval, mm-hmm. period. And there is very much an understanding of them as, like, a thing that enhances one's life. Good. So, you know, and you will see stuff about kind of, like, debates about animals' souls and things as a result of that, because people were into pets. But, and then another fun one is sometimes they would keep, like, squirrels. That's like a thing. So, you know, in the way that people sometimes have hamsters, people would keep squirrels.
Yeah. So, squirrels are hard to catch, though. That's cool. Good for them. I'm just impressed they caught them.
Yeah. And also, if you're interested in this, I know a woman who works on this, whose name is Kathleen Walter Mieke, I think. She works on medieval pets in particular, and she's got books out on medieval cats and medieval dogs, which are like short and easy and have like, real cool pictures. So there you go. Recommend there.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Now, since me and Eleanor both have cats.
That's right.
Or both have Manx cats. I'm going to look up when the Manx evolved, because they're cool.
They'd probably be around. They're so cute. They're very good.
For my own edification at this point.
They must have been around in the medieval period, I'd imagine. Like, it would take a while, I would think,
It just says they've been around for a very long time.
Cabbage, have you heard that? You've been around for a very long time.
There you go.
She's coming back over. She's like, what's all this? You can have some treats if you promise to leave me alone while I record a podcast.
Ooh, treats.
She's like, absolutely no fucking deal, but I take the treats. there you go. So, yeah. And the fun fact about Manx cats, the folklore about it is that a cat mated with a rabbit, which is why, and sometimes they are called cabbits as a result of that.
I did not know that. That's fun.
That is fun. So
I'm going to tell my wife that. She'll get a kick out of that.
It's not true, obviously. Say, it's simply a dominant trait to not have a tail. That's all.
Yeah, the thing about the Manx is that they don't have a tail, or they have a very short nub.
Yeah.
And a lot of times people be like, oh no, that cat's tail got cut off. And when that happens, it is very bad. But Manx actually have very good balance.
Yeah, because they never had a tail. It's just not necessary for them. It's like a bobcat, you know, that's what they're like. That's all.
They're agile as hell. And they like water for some reason, even though they don't like being in water. They all like it. I don't know why.
I don't know what it is. Like, cabbage likes to kind of like wade in the sink and hang out when I'm in the bathtub and stuff like that. So, they're cool. Get yourself one. Get yourself a Manx cat. Why not?
Yeah, exactly. All right, now that we've had our advertisement for the Manx cat,
that's Manx cat corner.
We would ask you to subscribe to our Patreon that really should have more content about Manx cats. It's patreon.com/WNSDpod. We have fun. We do episodes. We got to do a couple episodes for April. Maybe we should talk about, I don't know. We'll figure something out.
Yeah.
I was gonna say something, but then I couldn't think of anything pithy. So here we are with this terrible thing. Anyway, if you like hearing more terrible segues from me, then by all means, please do subscribe. $5 a month, patreon.com/WNSDpod. Okay, so now on to the main part of our episode. Last time, we tried our absolute damnedest to get through the entire pre-war period, or interwar period, but there was just too much tumult for us to pull it off. What were we supposed to do, give short shrift to the Spartacist uprisings and the failed World Communist Revolution, or ignore the Great Depression? There's just too much going on. So we had to stop off in roughly 1931 before we could cover fascism, the rise of Hitler, Nazi Germany, imperialist Japan, and the events leading up to the war. So we're going to start with those. Then it's time for World War II, baby. Finally, it's the actual war to end all wars. No, really, we promise. No more wars after this one. Mm-hmm. It's the last true epoch shift in world history, when a better future could be imagined for the entire planet, very briefly before international capitalism and the weird inner workings of American politics became intertwined and ended that dream, at least for the time being. But really, World War II needs no introduction, so I won't belabor one. We're still very consciously living in its shadow after all, so let's fucking go.
Woo!
Eleanor. Fascism.
Hey.
What is fascism? What does it actually mean? And why don't we say, or why didn't Marx say, or any materialist today say, that there's a fascist mode of production after capitalism as a future step in historical materialism?
Absolutely great questions. So first of all, fascism, like, as a distinct kind of form of authoritarianism, mm-hmm. which is what it is. We got the term specifically from Mussolini. Mussolini came up with it in 1919. It's from the Italian word fascio, which means kind of like a bundle or a group. And from that, there's also a thing called like a fascist, which it's like an axe with a bunch of sticks bound to it. And this is like a big symbol of the fascist movement in Italy. And as like you can tell from like the bundle or group thing, basically fascism is a kind of way of looking at things that requires ethnic division. Okay. There has to be an ethnic division between an inner group and an outer group. And as a part of that, you have to kind of like invent a sort of mythic past where, and in general, the members of said mythic past will also have an empire. And so the fascists will say that they are kind of like talking about a present loss of this former empire, which they believe is kind of like the natural end state of this particular ethnic group dominating the world, whether that's like, you know, militarily, politically, culturally. They just think that everyone will do that. So, you know, the fascists use Rome, for example, in Italy. Within that, there are also some like specific things that they need. So there is a specific call out for anti-liberalism. So it's kind of rejecting individual rights and civil liberties, and like even democracy at some point in time, in order to kind of like, again, promote the conception of the group over the individual. There is also specific anti-socialism within it. So, and the rejection of economic principles or socialist frameworks. The violent exclusion of other ethnic groups, and also like the expansion of the nation's kind of power. Is part of it. So for this, you need an in-group and an out-group. So, you know, think, you know, quote-unquote Aryans for Germany or, you know, whatever. But then also within this, there are, like, some specific ways of thinking about the world. So, for example, you know, like, one of the big myths that we all kind of play into in the modern world is this idea that humans are equal, which is not true. Humans should be equal. Fascism presupposes that humans are not, in fact, equal, and there's like no one's like trying to get that, and they say that this kind of like inequality is innate, essentially. So there's always going to be hierarchy within groups, and so like your rank in society should necessarily be a specific way because of, you know, like essentially biological concerns. Like it's pretty like intensely, like stupidly ethno-nationalist. And I mean, the way, there's kind of like a reason, right, that this isn't considered itself a stop on the line towards communism in terms of historical materialism. And that's because it's also intrinsically tied to capitalism. So, you know, we're already in it, you know, like specifically like, you know, it requires capitalism in order to survive. So basically, one of the things that they wish to do is kind of like set up capitalists as necessarily tied to the state. So, you know, it's a good thing for companies to be producing like weapons, for example, you know, for wars. But they have to make sure that also that they don't like enrich kind of like people who are from outside of, you know, the acceptable fascist groups, so like loyalties. And so this is why Marx doesn't see a necessity of saying, oh, a fascist mode of production, because that's just capitalism.
Just another facet.
Yeah. It's like this is, you know, in some ways you could say that fascism is kind of like the logical endpoint of nationalism, really. You know, like if you want to, you know, like not to put to find a point on it, but fascism is what you get when people really believe in nationalist myths and are also capitalists. This is just what happens. So you don't need a distinct phase of it, because it's like, baby, we in it. Like this is what's going on, right? We're living it. So, you know, you don't have to say there's a fascist mode of production, because this is just what capitalists will do if you leave them alone, basically.
Yep. Yeah, yeah. I've heard it said fascism is just when an empire turns its colonialist policies, the policies that and the horrors that they inflict on the colonies, inward.
Yeah.
On an othered group. And, you know, I certainly didn't come up with that, but yeah, that's...
Yeah. So it's like, fascists, you know, like, I suppose that one of the differences between kind of like fascist society and liberal society here in the imperial core, like under capitalism, is that liberal society likes to imagine that there is some form of equality within the imperial core, whilst ignoring the violence on the colonial periphery. Whereas fascism wishes there to be violence in both the imperial core and the external, external kind of colonial.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Oh, it's just a feel good episode today.
Yeah. Fascism, I guess, first comes into being formally under Mussolini in Italy in 1922 when he leads the March on Rome and... the king basically gives him power.
Yeah.
Around right after that, there's a guy named Hitler in Germany.
Yeah.
And he starts to make a name for himself, and he gets arrested for trying a coup and writes a book called Mein Kampf. And yeah.
I'd just like to point out here, compare and contrast. Marches on various capitalisms with paramilitary groups and like violent armed people between the treatment of fascists and the treatment of communists. Just like, here you go. Here is just an object lesson where it's like, basically, you know, when you have the March on Rome, the king is like, well, fair enough.
Yeah.
There you go. I guess we're all just fascists now. And it's like, sure, Hitler gets arrested. They don't fucking kill him.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like, he gets sent to prison even though he openly tried a coup.
Yeah,
he just gets sent to prison. And they had, I don't know if it's apocryphal, but I saw something that they had to like talk most of the judges into actually sentencing him at all because they were in his camp.
Yeah, so. Rosa got killed, you know.
Rosa got killed by supposedly, I mean, and in many ways, a leftist, left of center government.
Yeah. So, like, this is just, you know, like, liberals are telling you. Liberals are telling you who gets away with what. So just, like, keep that under your hat.
Yeah, and that's going to come back in Italy in after World War II in a big way. And a preview for next episode in a little thing called Gladio. Oh, boy. That's fun, and by fun I mean not at all. Hitler, after he gets out of jail on his light sentence for, you know, doing a coup, he leads the Nazis into power by the early 1930s. And anti-Semitism is baked in.
Oh, yeah. Oh, is it ever? Oh, baby.
Yeah. A series of anti-Semitic laws were passed beginning in 1933, the Nuremberg Laws in 1935, more legislation in 1938, and, of course, the first concentration camps for Jews opened at Dachau in 1933. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, and there are a lot, obviously, there are a lot of other aspects to, you know, Nazi policy, you know, the Übermensch, the Untermensch, the superior race, extreme, virulent anti-communism. Lebensraum, Eleanor. Can you correct my pronunciation?
No, Lebensraum. Lebensraum is correct.
Yeah.
Just, you know, you did it, baby. Yeah.
Lebensraum. Just German for manifest destiny, as far as I'm concerned. It's not really, but it might as well be. They learned it from watching us, literally. Eleanor, briefly, the Nazis learning a lot from America and Britain, for that matter.
Yeah. Like, for me, you know, as a Czech and Slovak person, Lebensraum is a... one for me, but it's just kind of, so you've got the idea with Lebensraum of, like, in the first place, like, Germans need, like, so it's like there's a kind of idea that there's a natural development of of territories growing, right?
Yeah.
Oh, like great empires will simply naturally grow. It's manifest destiny, or Lebensraum if you do it when you are German or Nazis. And so the idea is that it's like, basically, you do some settler colonialism in places like Poland, then Czechoslovakia, Belarus. Hey, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, help yourself. Get on up there. Like, basically, if a Teutonic Knight ever showed up, then, like, here you go. Like, that's for Germans now. And, like, Lebensraum literally means living space. But it's just settler colonialism in Europe. That's all.
And they're very upset. Our Treaty of Westphalia, they cried. Neville Chamberlain cried about the Treaty of Westphalia while appeasing Hitler.
I would be a bad Czech and Slovak person if I didn't talk specifically about the annexation of Czechoslovakia within this, which is fucking hilarious, right? Because if you, like, friends will remember when we talked about the Treaty of Versailles, one of the things that the Germans were forbidden from doing was, for example, owning tank factories. There was a meeting, get this meeting, in 1938, France and Britain met with Italy and Germany in Munich, locked the Czechoslovakians in the hallway, and gave Czechoslovakia to Germany. So, because the French and English people can just do that. They could just give your country away if they want. Where do you think the tank factories in Central Europe were?
Czechoslovakia.
That is correct. Ding, 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 ding. Pilsen. So they were like, and now you promise that if we just give you, like, these dog people, these Slavs, they're not really people. Like, yeah, why don't you turn them into, like, some Germans? Go for it. Mm-hmm. You promise you won't do a world war with all their tank factories? And Hitler is like, oh, yeah. Yeah, fine.
For sure, man.
We literally have, video. We have film of the Czechoslovakian contingent being locked in the hallway pacing while Czechoslovakia was given away by France and England. Good job. Well done.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. I got nothing. Yep. I got nothing for that. Is fascism and the rise of Hitler.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
But before we move on, we have to talk about Imperial Japan, because there are a lot of bad guys in World War II, but there are two, Italy too, but I don't like letting Italy off the hook,
because everyone always lets Italy off the hook, and it's fucking wild. If you go to Italy, which I do, like, you go around Italy, and they still have, like, plaques up in all these places being like, and here's when Mussolini visited. Like, I was in Marsala, like a Marsala, you know, like, cellar, as one does. And they're like, so, and like, the tour guide pointed it out. Like, oh, Jesus Christ, we're so proud of when Mussolini fucking visited. Like, that's how much Italians are fascist, is that they're not even ashamed. Like, at all. Like,
We should note that not all Italians are fascist.
Like,
but,
I love you guys. Keep doing what you're doing.
They do seem pretty proud about that shit. And they still have not taken my advice, which the only statue of a person that should exist is a bronze cast of Mussolini being hung upside down.
Yeah, that would whip.
His body being hung upside down.
Yeah.
From a lamppost, I believe. Yeah,
anyway,
so
sorry for my Italian tangent. I just got caught up about it.
Not at all. Not at all. Imperial Japan. After defeating Russia in 1905, at the crucial battle of the Tsushima Straits, they forcibly annexed the Korean Peninsula in 1910. You know, they sided with the Allies in World War I, but used this time to expand their influence across the Pacific and mainland China. They, at one point, overplayed their hand in China after making secret 21 demands, which would have effectively made China a protectorate of Japan. And so they withdrew the demands after public outcry, but, you know, then they later invaded. And just as a side note here, if you're wondering why we haven't talked about the end of Imperial China, we're going to touch on that when we get to the Chinese Communist Revolution, which will be next time. The U.S. cut off war material shipments to Japan in 1938. Cut off steel shipments in 1940, and then finally oil in July of 1941. And without sufficient natural resources on their small island chain, Japan moves towards militarism to achieve its goals of imperial expansion. Democracy fails in the early 30s. Japan comes a military dictatorship. They first signed the Com Intern Pact, which is the Communist International Pact. It's anti-communist pact, obviously, with Nazi Germany in 1936. Invade China once during the first Sino-Japanese War in 1931, and then in 1937 they did it again, and that one would last until the end of World War II. Established a bunch of puppet governments, puppet states in 1940. Not great. During the Second Sino-Japanese War, you get what is called the Rape of Nanjing in 1937 and 38, which is at least 200,000 dead and at least 20,000 to 80,000 cases of rape, mass rape, gang.
They refuse to apologize for. Fun fact. Like, currently.
Heavy shit. And then in 1940, they signed the Tripartite Pact with Germany and Italy, creating the Axis, and thus, getting Japan involved in World War II. Co-prosperity sphere, that's their Lebensraum.
The thing is, like, it's a difficult one, because the thing of it is, they're just doing imperialism.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting because we don't like it when people do imperialism, for example, in Europe. It's like, oh, you're not supposed to do that. Like, imperialism is something that people are supposed to do far away. Like, mm-hmm. it's kind of like what our thing is. So, like, our revulsion and, like, quick condemnation of these groups of individuals is an interesting one, because we don't so quickly condemn, for example, Britain for, I don't know, like, taking over India for some good God. Like, but there is this kind of thing about it being, like, when it's far away, it's all right. When it's next to you, it's unacceptable.
Yeah.
And this is kind of, like, a real line that a lot of people have, and, like, especially within Europe, in this context, like, obviously what Japan does as well is really held up, but people don't have these same kind of objections if it is, for example, Australia or South America. You know, there are hierarchies at play here. Let's just put it that way.
Co-prosperity sphere expands. It was like an idea in 1895, and then in 1895 it kind of started, not formally, informally, when Japan invaded Taiwan, and then by 1940, they had taken over a bunch of European colonial holdings and folded all of them into the co-prosperity sphere, including Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, Thailand, the Philippines, Burma, and large parts of China. Yeah, so that is Imperial Japan, and there are just a few things that happen real quick that are big deals right here before the war. Italy invades Ethiopia in 1935, which exposed the League of Nations as a fraud because both were members of the League. Interestingly enough, when the Soviet Union invades Finland in the Winter War in 1940, the Soviet Union does get kicked out of the League of Nations for that, you know, so...
Again, it's all like, oh yeah, but that's white people, right? Fun fact, Ethiopians have their own distinct form of lasagna that absolutely fucking whips as a result of this. So it's bad. My take is that it's bad that Italy invaded Ethiopia, but Ethiopian lasagna whips. So get you some of that if you can. That's all.
I'll look that up. I've never heard of that.
There you go.
Yeah. Spanish Civil War, another banner moment, 1936 to 39, nationalists and fascists under Francisco Franco fight against a large coalition known as Republicans that included anarchists, socialists, communists, social democrats, liberals, and several Spanish states just attempting to break away, like the Basque Country and Catalonia. Unfortunately, the fascist won, and George Orwell got shot in the neck and then wrote a book about it. And well, as they say, they should have been a better shot and got him in the head. His book sucked. And he turned in communist and socialist to the British government. So that's my spiel about George Orwell.
We hate to see it.
Yep. Got shot in the neck.
Yeah.
Was too damn tall to stand in a trench. Who would have thought?
Like, imagine, because, you know, like, on the face of it, it absolutely is an incredible baller move to go fight the fascists. Like, yes, extremely good. But then, you know, instead he sucked. So, you know.
Yep.
It's interesting. It's a real heel turn. Real heel turn.
Yeah.
Yeah.
1938, Kristallnacht, the Night of Glass in Germany. That really kicks everything into gear. Going forward, 1938, Germany annexes Austria, makes claims on the Sudetenland, which is in Czechoslovakia.
Yep.
Neville Chamberlain does some light appeasement. And by light, I mean total. In 1939, the rest of Czechoslovakia is invaded, and they began moving closer to invading Poland, whose sovereignty had been guaranteed by Britain and France. And then, lastly, the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact is signed by Germany and the Soviet Union after talks between an alliance between Britain, France, and the Soviet Union stall in 1939. Ribbentrop-Molotov Pact is one of those things that bad. It's bad to sign an agreement with fascists.
Don't do that.
Bad to allied their invasion of Poland, so you can partition Poland. However, it did work out in the end. So
yeah. So who's
gotta
to
give
say?
It that?
Yeah.
You know they. Yep. Stalin. Got his act together, and they got the army together, and you know they were able to pull it out. So it worked out in the end, but still bad. Don't do that in the future, anyone, please. Yeah. So World War II formally began on September 1st, 1939, with Germany's invasion of Poland. Britain demanded that Germany cease their aggression, but this was ignored. 2 days later, on September 3rd, Great Britain, France, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, and Canada declared war on Germany. And hey, hey, that's definitely a war right there.
Yo.
Eleanor, what are the wider causes of this?
Oh, Treaty of Versailles is like the big one. Turns out that if you like deliberately impoverish a country, like just because of your feelings about it, that's bad. And it will make, it'll make sad men's peepees hurt. And they will become fascists and come for your ass. So that's one of them. I would also say that within Germany more generally, one of the issues that you've got right here is the willingness to appease fascists because of scary communists. So like, you know, they're given a little bit more room to run than they really ought to have been. And that's because fascists aren't a problem. Yeah. For capitalism, like
unless they threaten the overall world order,
like it's completely fine. You know, like you know, Germany and France will just be like, yeah, go ahead, have a whole ass country. I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
Like that doesn't bother me. You know, it's the only time that fascism becomes a problem is if it starts to mess with the bottom line of other capitalist countries. And so yeah, like the issue is. El problema es el capitalismo, as normal, you know, here. And also there is, you know, just the issue of like Lebensraum more generally. So it's like, you know, again, as I say, like this is just imperialism, but white people thought that they all agreed that you can't do imperialism to white people unless it's Ireland or it's okay to like do imperialism to Ireland. It's okay to do imperialism to Czechoslovakia, apparently. But there's like hard lines about what it is. And like part of that is like Poland, they decided was a special case. I'm still not exactly quite sure what the difference is. Like, I mean, as a Slav myself, like noted Slav, Dr. Eleanor Janica, like I'm not really exactly quite sure why it is that like Poland is the one. I don't know. Maybe it's just because it's bigger, like than us. But like,
well, they just got done redrawing all those maps. They had to put it back on there after all those partitions, and they were like, well, we don't want to redraw it. We don't want to do these maps again.
Exactly. So you know, there's kind of like that. But. Basically, it's just sort of like that was getting a little too like it will disrupt the social order of things. And then that's also kind of like in conjunction with like the co-prosperity sphere. So, you know, for example, the British really don't like it if you team up with the Japanese, considering that the Japanese was like very busy gobbling like French and British holdings. So it's like the French are like, well, hey, Vietnam is ours.
As you do,
English, you know, believed that they were the owners of various bits of China, so you know, things like that. So it's that is eating into the bottom line for them in other places, and that is how you spur capitalists into a war with fascists. It has to be about their bottom line being fucked with.
And that's how you get the only time in history when Britain, France, and the United States could even be loosely considered to be the good guys.
Yeah.
And that's when you're fighting literally the worst villain in human history. Yep, the progress of World War II. Why are we focusing on the specifics of this war when we glossed over most? Because it just sets up everything that comes next, even our lives today, which are directly impacted by these events. And are going to explain a lot about why Russia and China have a lot of trouble after this, surviving when they get cut off from the rest of the world. 1939, 1940, the Nazis romped through Central and Western Europe France surrenders in June 1940, and Vichy France is established. There's, you know, Dunkirk, you know, everybody remembers Dunkirk. Especially if you're in England,
Hilariously, whilst everyone remembers Dunkirk, allegedly, they seem to have not got the memo that it was a bad thing. The boomer commemoration of World War II is absolutely fucking wild over here.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's like everyone here, all the boomers had a bad relationship with their parents because their parents were so like mentally scarred from World War II, and the boomers have decided that that meant that World War II was a good thing. I don't know.
And World War II happened to them.
A lot of
people who are my dad's age, and my dad was born. My dad is like one of the earliest boomers. Seemed to act like they lived in the Blitz, and yeah,
they did not.
I really think that's possible. The Blitz, Battle of Britain. The Nazis can't quite break England, but this also means that England is not physically or emotionally spared from the horrors of World War. Not good for any involved there. June 1941, the Nazis, in a move that everyone saw coming, broke the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact and invaded the USSR in Operation Barbarossa.
Fucking idiots.
Yep. This forced the USSR to sign an alliance with Britain in July 1941, thus bringing them into the Allied fold. The Eastern Front, a.k.a. the Axis-Soviet War, is the largest military operation in human history, involving more than 6.7 million soldiers, 14,000 tanks, and 15,000 aircraft. The Eastern Front also accounted for more total engagements and deaths than every other theater of World War II combined. And Germany started out strong, but they got bogged down at Leningrad, and they never actually made it to Moscow.
Yeah.
Thanks to the sacrifice of millions of Russian soldiers and civilians and their broken supply lines and, of course, Russian winter. You know, that always helps. Nice cherry on top when everybody gets stuck in a blizzard outside of Moscow. Mm. Seems to be a problem. Though, I will note that, a lot of the stuff you see about, Hitler could have done this, if we went back and he could have won Operation Barbarossa, why you would want that, I don't know. But, you see people say that and they're like, he just needed to know this, 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 and this. And it's like, he knew. They knew about Russian winter and they knew about Napoleon. They studied that whole thing very thoroughly. They just thought they could make it to Moscow before all that became a problem. And
They couldn't.
Yeah. Yeah, because when you have to fight through, the entire land size of Europe to get to Moscow,
It's hard.
It's hard. Yeah.
Yeah. People act as though it's just like a bowling alley or something. Like you just it's not like this is a massively populated place that everyone is fighting you every step of the way. You know, it's very difficult. That's all. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about the Holocaust in a moment, and those horrors, the Nazis also decided to inflict similar horrors on Bolsheviks, who they, of course, called Judeo-Bolsheviks, which if you ever hear that, it's definitely a Nazi or fascist dog whistle.
Yep.
For someone trying to do some bad shit. And they killed 8.6 million Russian soldiers, including 3.3 million murdered in POW camps, which they didn't do that to the other allied prisoners.
And they wouldn't, because they're fascists, right? Yeah. That's the thing. It's like they're fascists, and so as a result, they'll kill communists, but they won't kill capitalists.
They were white. Or associated with the white nations, whereas Russia was, Slavs or Mongols or, Judeo-Bolsheviks or whatever word you would like. Yeah,
yeah. The Nazis notably did not believe that Slavs were white. and they intended, for example, to eradicate us from Czechoslovakia and Poland. eventually as well. And they had the same plans for the Russians. And it's kind of like a part of the ongoing contingent whiteness of Slavic people. Like, yeah. I mean, we're definitely white. I want to make that exceptionally clear. But other white people don't tend to think that at all times.
Yeah.
Especially fascists, and especially if you are a communist. So, yep.
All told, the Axis forces, which was mostly Germany, but hey, let's not forget Romania, Hungary, Finland, and Italy. Yeah, they killed 21.6 million Russians. And yeah, that includes 13 million Russian civilians, many of whom were starved out, which is roughly 13% of the pre-war Soviet population. And in Western Russia, more than 1,700 cities and towns were razed. 1,700.
It's just,
yeah. Why did the Soviet Union have such a hard time after World War One or after World War Two? Well, because
that.
Even they were rapidly industrializing, and then they were the entire western half of the country was burned to the ground.
And then they had to like beat the Nazis.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Yeah, because it's like in terms of beating the Nazis, it's like Russia. Mm-hmm. And then there's a big jump down, and then it's, you know, England and France and the Allies, and then America shows up too, you know, to do our part, you know,
aka a war crime.
Yeah, aka lots of war crimes. But hey, we will get to the atom bomb in a moment. Japan attacked Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941, in an attempt to cripple the U.S. fleet in the Pacific. Once again, in the face of popular convention, Pearl Harbor was well planned. They knew it was going to happen. They did it on purpose. The Germans knew it was going to happen. No one on the Axis side was surprised by this, and they knew that the U.S. would get into the war because of it. Yep.
Yeah.
U.S. joins UK, the UK, the USSR, Free France, Chiang Kai-shek's China, and more as the Allied powers. And now we get World War One, you know, in effect. And that means we have to now talk about the Holocaust.
We have to talk about the Holocaust. It's just so sad, you know.
Yeah.
That's just so sad. That's
yeah.
All.
I'm going to run through this and then we can talk about it. It's very sad. Though the anti-Semitic policies began long before, and Polish Jews suffered heavily, beginning with the invasion in 1939. The mass killings and implementation of the so-called Final Solution began in earnest in 1941, and really ramped up after America's entry into the war because of Hitler's weird views about international Jews controlling the U.S. Yeah. Extermination camps were built in Poland in late 1941. By 1945, the Nazis and their collaborators had murdered some 6 million Jews, which was one-third of the total number of worldwide pre-war Jews and two-thirds of the total number of European Jews. And, of course, the Holocaust also included mass extermination, other mass extermination orders like ethnic Poles, Roma, homosexuals, but very, very targeted at gay men, religious dissident, other religious dissidents like Jehovah's Witnesses, I'm sorry, who they consider religious dissidents, and as we said, the Soviets as well, and Slavs generally, yeah.
Yeah, you could throw a Slav in there, why not?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, they didn't like the slaw. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
You guys know. I'm not doing a joke. You guys know. They didn't like slaw.
It's, you know, things to keep in mind about how depressing this is. The Roma term for the Holocaust is the devouring.
Jesus Christ.
Because, of how many of them were killed. And, you know, entire kind of, like, distinct forms of Romani people, like for example the Sinti, are almost like gone now. People don't like to talk about that because people in Europe are super racist about Roma and gypsies. The Tory party who controls England literally had pogroms against gypsy Roma and traveler people in its manifesto in 2019 and won. We do a lot of racism towards traveling peoples.
However, the one I mean, literally, if you can only say one good thing about World War One, it did stop the global extermination of the Jews. And yeah, that's a very good thing.
Yeah, because we like that.
Hitler was not kidding. They nope. literally were not kidding about that. It stopped that. And yeah, that's...
And thank God. You know? Yeah. Like, it's... Yep. Yeah, I mean, no, they were really trying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They got way too far, you know?
And hey, while we're here, this is just... I'm just going to, off the top of my head, name a few companies that did business with the Nazis during World War II and while the Holocaust was going on and knew about it. Let's see. IBM... Henry Ford received a medal from Hitler.
Oh, of course he fucking did.
No, of the Ford company. Coca-Cola invented Fanta so it could be sold in fascist territories. I think that's how that happened. If I'm misremembering, whatever. Tyson Krupp, the elevator makers. BMW, of course. Basically every German company and a lot of American companies knew all about this and gave guns.
Hugo Boss, all those nice uniforms.
Yeah. Oh, good God, yeah.
Coco Chanel. Puma, both of them were real high up.
It's a long list. Includes many that we're missing. BASF. Oh, good God. Oh, good God. Those people who make all those chemicals. Of course.
God in heaven. Oh, Jesus Christ. That's grim.
Not saying that, you know, you have to boycott those companies now, but definitely should know about where they came from and why they're still around, even though they helped this out. Definitely shouldn't have had that happen. America, you know, moving on if we can, this is when America finally seals the success of the New Deal by fully funding it, by turning into a war production economy in 1941. Hey, hey, money printer, go.
That's the only other good thing about World War II is turning on the money printer.
Yep. And it's, America's been coasting on everything that was built right during this time. Ever since, we are coasting on it. All of it.
Every single thing that we ever did is just then. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Good times. We will come back to America momentarily. In the Pacific, the U.S. and Japan fight across a series of tiny islands and stretches of water. Japan has the early upper hand for some time, but then there's the Battle of Midway in 1942, which the U.S. wins. They spring the Japanese trap, and Admiral Hirohito's fleet the fleet under his command was somewhat annihilated. And it's usually the second or third most influential naval battle in world history after Trafalgar and the aforementioned Battle of the Tsushima Straits in 1905. So America's making progress, but hey, we have not talked about China yet. Mm-hmm. And China are the they're going to receive the second most deaths. They're the second most casualties of World War II. Way more than anyone besides the Soviets. China continues to fight Japan in guerrilla attacks and in open battles, leading to some stalemates, but mostly the Japanese inability to fully pacify China and thus redirect their soldiers elsewhere, like to focus on the U.S. or fighting in Burma or wherever else they were going. Chinese losses were tremendous. By 1945, roughly 15 million Chinese people had died, at least 3 million soldiers and 12 million civilians. And this is, as I said, the second most casualties in World War II. Why did China have to industrialize after World War II? Well, because they've been fighting a guerrilla war for their own survival against Japan since 1937.
And no one came to help.
You know? Nope. America started sending money and guns eventually, but no one came to help until the very end when the Soviets came, and then the Americans came with the bombs. Hey, let's move on to that brief moment that we talked about where there was a vision for the future of the world being slightly better. And that is FDR's reelection in 1944. Prior to this, FDR had had a vice president whose name was Henry Wallace. And Henry Wallace is something of a darling to the American left, not mostly for his policies, but because he was a, depending on who you asked, a communist, a stooge for communist, you know, basically a mouthpiece for American communist movement. And he was the vice president from 1940 to 1944. And once we repeat that again, a guy who is considered, lovingly considered a communist stooge by many on the American left, was the second in line for the presidency of the United States from 1940 to 1944. Gets taken off the gets taken off the ticket for Truman, Eleanor, Henry Wallace, and the future of the world.
I mean, it really sucks because Henry Wallace, like, better than Truman is what
what
I would say. And like, so he'd been kicking around in American circles for a while before that. Like, he had been the Secretary of Agriculture, he was the Secretary of Commerce. He cutely, like, after all of this, he runs for president with the Progressive Party in 1948, which I fucking love. And like, he's a nice little Iowan boy, which, you know, is how you get like a communist, right? Because, you know, he was not alienated from his labor, and saw what could be happening there. So, you know, like, he was really into stats, he was really into economics, and he was quite taken with FDR when FDR kind of ran in 1932. Mm-hmm. And so that's how he gets into the Secretary of Agriculture and things. I mean, like, let us not forget. So this is like, FDR is in for ages.
Yeah.
Just for like absolute fucking yonks, right? So basically, they win in 1940. And like, pre-World War II, Wallace is super, super involved. Basically, the, stop me if you've heard this one, like, right-wing Democrats don't like that. And so, like, you kind of had to have, like, you had to sort of, like, be renominated as, it isn't, like, a done deal that you're going to, like, be renominated as, like, the vice presidential guy. And so the right-wing Democrats go really hard to, like, try to stop that from happening and get Truman in his place for all of the reasons, kind of, like, already kind of, like, stated. So, you know, he was seen as being too close to, for example, unions. He was also kind of like really trying to, in his own words, like, he called himself the assistant president, not like the vice president. The way he saw himself was like kind of like as being involved. He was really also kind of like he was involved in the War Production Board in 1942, which are the people who turned the money printer on. And so he kind of like was directly responsible for like just, you know, turning the money machine on because he knew that it will happen. He was cool and said things like, so he like his best speech, like, in my opinion, or I mean, well, the one I know about anyone, and there's a reason why, it involves the phrase, the century of the common man. So the 20th century is going to be about like common people, but he really spoke not. He's got this really great quote, which I've brought up here, which is that peace must mean a better standard of living for the common man, not merely in the United States and England, but also in India, Russia, China, and Latin America, not merely in the United Nations, but also in Germany and Italy and Japan. So you see where that gets you.
Yeah.
So basically they had to get rid of him and put Truman, who fucking sucks, in instead, because we're not allowed to have nice things.
And I think the idea here is that, you know, is not that either FDR, if he had lived, or Henry Wallace are going to, you know, after World War II turn and bow the knee to Stalin and the Soviet Union and, you know, do all that kind of stuff, which was like the popular idea. It was more like at the end of World War II, we have to figure out a way to adjust to the new world. And is that going to be a new world where the U.S., which is going to come out of this basically unscathed in terms of like physical damage, are we going to use that to like rebuild the whole world, or are we only going to use that to rebuild the part of the world that is capitalist, and what are we going to do in a quote-unquote post-colonial world? Are we going to like bring those colonial nations up and give them money and, you know, actually apologize and do right by what we did? Or are we going to have what actually happened? And and that's when you get, you know, the idea in your mind is, you know, that Henry Wallace is not afraid of Molotov like Truman was, and you know, he's not some brain dead hick, and I don't mean that as bad. I have plenty of relatives who are hicks and they're very nice people. I mean that as Truman was just a fucking hillbilly idiot who I despise for many reasons. You know, that was the dream, very briefly. You know, that was the last. If the World Communist Revolution wasn't going to work, maybe we could move into a better future of like actual, like worldwide, you know, social democracy, which, again, not saying is preferable to communism, but is a hell of. Is way more preferable than what this is. Where we're all edging closer to precarity until we fall in, and then. We see what happens when the world shakes out after this. But hey, we'll get there. In Europe, the Allies fight through North Africa and Italy, and in June 1944, land in Normandy and begin freeing France from Nazi control. Nazi war machine falls completely apart, and the Allies in the West and the Soviets in the East race for Berlin. On April 27, 1945, Mussolini is captured by Italian partisans and is summarily executed by firing squad. His body is hung upside down from a lamppost, I believe, in a gas station parking lot.
Rest in peace, motherfucker.
Yeah, one of the most cathartic deaths in human history. You deserved it, you piece of shit. 3 days later, April 30th, 1945, Adolf Hitler puts a bullet in his fucking head.
Woo!
Yeah. Rest in piss. However, he also then became the person who killed the worst villain in human history. But it was himself, so fuck off, you dead piece of shit.
Asshole.
All the awful shit you caused. Victory in Europe. And I guess this is also the time to say that we should have taken Stalin and FDR's idea that we should kill all of the Nazi officers. After the war,
but we did Operation Paperclip caused, instead.
Which caused Winston Churchill to go into hysterics about how dare we kill Nazis. Don't think Stalin was really joking about that. FDR might have been half joking. Still, what we should have done, just like what we should have done at the end of the Civil War. But hey.
You should kill Nazis, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. I just think you should. I think it's a good thing to do with them. So there you go.
Yep. That leaves only the Pacific Theater to be dispensed with. Japan is still occupying large parts of Eastern Asia and fighting land wars in China and Burma, all while fighting the U.S. at sea. The U.S. kept hopping those islands all the way to retaking the Philippines, winning victories at Iwo Jima and then Okinawa in April 1945. The Chinese push back, retake Guangxi in early August of 1945. Then, in what is probably the most, in my opinion, the most consequential event in human history, on August 6, 1945, America drops a nuclear weapon on Hiroshima, the first nuclear attack in world history, and followed it 3 days later by dropping another nuke on Nagasaki. Japan then formally surrendered, and World War II ended on September 2nd, 1945. Eleanor, the atom bomb.
That's bad.
Why did it happen?
America was flexing on Russia. Well, the USSR. And interestingly, hilariously, like, I mean, I got taught this in fucking AP US history in the United States in the 1990s. You had to like that is not a contentious thing to say, like, like from a historical standpoint. This is what pretty much every historian worth their salt agrees on. Like, Japan were fucked. Like, we were already in Okinawa, like, that's which is like Japan proper. Like, I mean, it's not Honshu, sure, but like it's Japan. Like, I don't know what to tell you. Everybody was starving. Everybody wanted to surrender. Like, it's the myths about there's all these myths, right? There's this big myth, which I got in an argument, like, on my when I was 21, when I first moved to Australia with all my Australian friends, because they were repeating this thing about, like, no, America did it to save the lives of it would have cost this many soldiers, and like, and that's just a myth. That's just like a complete myth. That's like, it isn't true, but it's a piece of propaganda which is repeated ad nauseum because of the absolutely fucked up thing that America did for no good goddamn reason.
Yeah.
There was absolutely no reason to drop bombs on a bunch of civilians at all whatsoever. But what America was doing was showing the Soviets that they had a weapon that the Soviets did not have. Of course, this did nothing but encourage the Soviets to also go get that weapon.
Yep.
Which they did not have. It's how you get a nuclear proliferation. And also, it is what allows Japanese people to portray themselves now as victims of World War II. Which is something that is very commonly asserted, I can say. I can say from my time living in Japan. So, because, you know, this terrible, unconscionable thing happened to them. And so as a result, they say, oh, well, we're one of the very wronged groups, well, they're not wrong. This was a horrible war crime, that never should have been committed. But on the other hand, like, yo, it's, And, basically this is, you must think about the bombs being dropped on Japan in certain ways in the first place. Japanese people, by virtue of being Asian, were seen as being expendable. It's okay to kill, to vaporize them, or, you know, I mean, I don't even want to get into how disgusting it is, but, you know, it was seen as like an okay thing to do because they weren't white, so you could just kind of go for it.
Yep.
And also, you need to think of the bomb as also kind of like a part of, it's like the space race. In the same way, there's this kind of ideological battle happening between communism and capitalism for, like, who can get these particularized technological advances. And of course, America went for the really fucked up one. And this is why you get stuff that's happening, like, for example, right now in Ukraine, where we can't do shit because nuclear arms exist. So good job, everyone.
Yep.
Nice work.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, not gonna spend a ton of time preaching to the choir here.
Y'all wouldn't be listening to this if you didn't agree with us, you know.
Like. Yeah. You know, just real quick, I think one of the best ways, if you're someone like myself who was always taught that this was done to stop, you know, the U.S. loss of lives from invading Japan, which is, by the way, something you sign up when you do war. Your soldiers are going to die. That's part of doing war. Mm. You don't drop two giant bombs on cities that were mostly filled with women, children, hospitals, and old men. But a couple of things here. I think it's, you know, it's good to look at some of the people who famously opposed the bombing at the time. Dwight Eisenhower said that he bitterly opposed dropping the bomb, or said that, Dwight Eisenhower said he had grave misgivings about it and believed that dropping the bomb was completely, quote, completely unnecessary. Mm-hmm. That's quoting his memoirs. So that's the leader of the Allied forces in Europe saying that dropping the bomb was not a military necessity. Others who said that Fleet Admiral Chester Nimitz, who's the commander of the U.S. Pacific Fleet, said it was not military and not a military necessity. Bull Halsey, another fleet admiral, said the same thing. William Lay, the chief of staff under Truman, said the same thing. And two people that you might not think, given their later actions, Curtis LeMay, who later will become known as Bombs Away Curtis LeMay, who famously ran a very short-lived campaign for president on giving Vietnam generals discretion to use nukes in the field. That was a Republican ticket. That was on the Republican ticket back in the 50s. Mm. And Douglas MacArthur also said it was militarily unnecessary. Douglas MacArthur, who famously threw fits to get Truman to allow him to nuke China and Korea during the Korean War, and went on to kind of talk about maybe throwing a coup against Truman, said it was not a military necessity. So yeah, a military necessity, not something that had to be done, something that was a flex on the vile commies. And you know, this is one of those things where you like to imagine that definitely FDR, I doubt he would have dropped them. Not to say that he is a good person, but would not be wanted to view by history as someone who did that. And Henry Wallace probably wouldn't, unless they drug him out and forced him to, because he was basically a Puritan. Like, I mean, I don't mean that as a rude thing. He was a teetotaler and a very religious person. There you go. Truman, yeah. We got the bombs, just one thing, you know, it really fucking, it's insane how scientifically important it is that we cracked the goddamn atom, the single smallest basis of like chemical elements in that we know of in existence. We cracked it, and then we immediately turned it into a fucking weapon.
I hate people sometimes, you know, it's like, honestly, anyway.
Yep, and now we got enough nukes to wipe out the human race like 100 times over, or something like that. Yeah.
And look at the good they're doing. Nope.
Yeah.
Nope.
Not at all. It's bad. I mean, what else is there to say?
Awful. There's nothing we can say. Like, we've got no great insight on this. It's just bad. That's all. It's just bad and sad, you know?
Yeah, it's awful. I mean, it was done to, whatever, you know, I mean, it was bad because it was done to like show up the Soviets. I mean, it was bad, you know, morally, regardless of there's no reason to do that, period. Even if you could show, which you can't, that it was 100% militarily necessary, I would still say, hey, fuck off. You don't do that.
No. So don't do that.
Yeah, you don't bomb, like,
I got an award. I didn't want my soldiers to die. Boo-hoo. Fuck you.
Basically, you know, the U.S. dropped, by the way, also dropped like tons and tons of bombs and early napalm on Japan during this time, which, also bad. Like, I mean, let's be clear. Japan did a whole lot of fucked up shit before.
That's not what we're saying.
World War II.
But
like firebombing it more than Dresden, more than any place up to that point in human history had ever been bombed. I think the only places after that that would get bombed more were Korea, Vietnam, and Laos, or Laos and Cambodia. Like,
if I ever fucking see Heather Kitchen.
Yeah, not great. Oh, all of this.
Redact that. Beep.
Yeah.
I simply hate him. Anyway.
Yeah. You guys get it. It's bad. This shit sucks. Fuck. I don't even know. This is.
Yeah. It's like you can't talk about World War II because it just sucks so much. We're just like sitting here in misery. So.
Yeah. Now I've made myself all sad. Next time, well, I would say it would get better. But hey, next time we're going to talk about stuff that isn't this depressing. So that's fun, right?
Yeah.
Before we go, Texan Trends, the defibrillator. That's cool.
I like that.
A precursor to the microwave. Mm-hmm. Werner von Braun invents the V2 rocket in 1939.
Fun fact, that's why my flat exists. So actually, I think it's a V1. Oh. V1. My block got leveled.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. It was either a V1 or a V2. And so now I live in a 60s block.
Yeah. And the first, the polio, also the polio vaccine was created.
That's good. We love that.
By Jonas Salk. I almost said Julius Salk, but that's not a person. Yeah. And of course, as we said, the atom bomb. Next time, post-war, Cold War, Korea. De-Stalinization.
Get ready to get depressed again, but for different reasons.
Yeah. The whole shit show. Yep. That's where it is. Eleanor, in the meantime, where can the people find you?
So I've been told that on Thursday, April the 7th, the first episode of my new TV show on Medieval Pleasures will be on the History Hit Network online. You can check that out, and that would help me. You can sign up for, like, you know, if you waited, you could sign up for, like, one of those, like, free trials and then just, like, watch all three episodes when they come out real quick. But, you know, if you've got it already, you know, watch a girl talk about sex. You love that shit. You can check out my comic book, The Middle Ages of Graphic History. My blog is going-medieval.com. And I, of course, am on Twitter too much at goingmedieval.
Yep, and you can find me on Twitter at LucasAmazing, and you can find my other show, it's about Star Wars, it's on hiatus right now, it's called A People's History of the Old Republic. You can find it wherever you're listening right now. In the meantime, thank you again so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Bye!